The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues. Here's today's guest host, Eric Townsend.
I'm Eric Townsend for the Financial Sense NewsHour. The Next Level is a new weekly program segment intended for advanced retail investors and industry professionals. This week's topic is a deeper focus on mechanics of precious metals markets. Joining me as my special guest in the program is Jeffrey Christian, founder of CPM Group. Jeff, thanks for joining me on The Next Level.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
What I want to do, Jeff, is to pick up on a conversation that I had a couple of weeks ago with Bron Suchecki over at Perth Mint. We talked about the effects of price transmission through arbitrage in precious metals markets. I'd like to take that conversation deeper, but why don't we first start by just getting a perspective on what are the major precious metal markets in the world?
Major precious metals markets in terms of volumes. I guess probably the largest and deepest market is what is called the London over-the-counter market. I think it's something of a misnomer. The trading is centered in London, but it's really a global network of over-the-counter gold trading. And, you know, it occurs in New York, Singapore, Hong Kong, and other centers as well. But it's clearly centered in London. And that is probably the largest volume. The second largest volume is probably the New York COMEX futures contract, where you have very large volumes of futures and exchange-traded options. And then there are a number of smaller markets. Shanghai is growing in importance. There's a contract in Mumbai, India, called the MCX, the Multi-Commodities Exchange, has a growing gold contract. And the ETFs, the most prominent of which is the GLD, traded on a New York Stock Exchange.
Let's go through these in order. Let's start with COMEX futures contracts. And what I want to do is give our listeners a sense of the details of this transaction process, both how these transactions are created and ultimately cleared. So if I look at my future screen today, on the day that we're speaking, I'll take the December of 2012 delivery month, for example, in gold. It's showing me a $1,630 price for that contract. So if I go ahead and buy one of those contracts, I'm essentially signing up to buy 100 troy ounces of gold through that market. Explain how that works. What's actually happening? What am I buying, and what is behind that trade?
What you're buying is a contract that gives you the right and obligation to purchase gold in December at $1,630. You have to put up collateral, or on the exchanges they call it margin, against that future, that commitment to buy that gold in the future. So initially, depending on who you are, you know, the exchange has a minimum margin requirement, and then your broker may have additional margin requirements that it imposes upon you, depending on your credit worthiness in the eye of the broker. But basically, you would be putting up maybe anywhere from 5 to 15% of the value of that 100-ounce gold contract. And so initially, what you can do is you can buy what they call leveraged position, where you're putting up 10% of the value of 100 ounces. That gives you the right to buy 100 ounces at 1630 in December, I think you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And you know, the problem, of course, is that if the price has fallen, you will lose money on that position.
Okay, so essentially I've done the equivalent of buying 100 ounces of gold, but I've done that transaction for low money down, if you will. I've put up about a 10% margin or collateral against that, and I have to make good on any losses that might occur, as if I had actually bought that 100 ounces today, and I get to profit from any profits that might occur if the price of gold goes up between now and December. But really, from now until the end of the month prior to the delivery month, it really is a situation where I can get in or out of that contract anytime that I want to, by buying or selling the equivalent contract in order to close the position. Then 1 month before the actual delivery date, the rules change a little bit. Why don't you explain how that works?
Well, in the final month prior to delivery, I don't think the rules actually change, but what happens is that you have actively traded months and inactive months. So November is an inactive month on the COMEX gold contract. December is an active month. And what you'll find is that there will be a lot of volume in the forward months, nearby active month and other forward active months. And that reflects a variety of transactions across commodities, not just gold and silver, but across commodities. About 99% of the futures contracts that are traded are settled, closed out or settled for cash. They never actually take delivery. But what you'll find is that people will hold those contracts into the month prior to delivery, and then as that final month progresses, the shorts and longs will tend to roll out because they neither plan to deliver nor take delivery of those contracts. You know, most of these people are financial investors. They're investing in a futures contract. They have no interest in either delivering into it if they're short or taking delivery if they're long. So they will roll out prior to the first delivery date of the gold contract, which is the last business day of the month prior to the contract month. So the last business day of November is the first delivery day for the December contract. And most people will have as a point to be out of them, their December positions, before they become deliverable.
For most traders, and I think this is true for actually something like 95% of all traders in the futures market, the transactions are really happening on paper. They're being settled for cash, and it's only a small percentage of those traders who stay in those positions beyond their first notice date and actually go into a delivery transaction. Most contracts are closed out before that happens. Now, for people who do go through the delivery process, explain how it works. It starts out with both of the longs and the shorts having to put up essentially the full value of the contract as opposed to a small margin. What happens from there?
Well, once you're into the delivery period, you can be delivered. Now, the delivery process on COMEX starts with the shorts, and let's take a step back. You know, the shorts and the longs have put collateral up with the COMEX clearinghouse, and they've done that when they started the contract. So if you're talking about, you know, June 2012 and you're doing a December contract, when the shorts and the longs initiate that their positions back in June, they have to put up collateral, and that collateral goes to the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse is a standalone corporation that runs parallel to the exchange that is there to assure the financial stability of the contract and the exchange, and to assure that all of the participants in the futures and options markets have the financial wherewithal to cover their positions. The delivery process is initiated by the shorts. So the first delivery day is, as I said, the last day of the month prior to the delivery contract date. So the last business day of November, shorts can go to the clearinghouse and say, I plan to deliver X ounces of silver against my short position in December tomorrow. The COMEX clearinghouse will take those receipts, in essence, and say, okay, fine, these guys have gold in a COMEX registered depository, and they want to deliver it tomorrow. The COMEX clearinghouse will arbitrarily distribute those clearing notices to people who still own long positions. And they will say overnight, okay, these guys are delivering into the December contract. You have stood for delivery into the delivery process. Congratulations. Here's a contract. You now own 100 ounces of gold stored in a COMEX registered depository. By the way, you now have to put up the full value to pay for that gold so that we could pay off the short that's delivering into it. So all of a sudden you go from a 10 or 15% margin requirement to 100% margin requirement, which is why 99% of the people get out before delivery, because they want to invest on the leverage and they don't necessarily want to put up the full value of 100 ounces of gold. So then the long takes delivery. Now, sometimes you'll find people who don't roll out soon enough, and they get caught with the delivery. And what they do, you know, there's a myth that you get hit with, you know, you'll hear the urban legends of, you know, a truck pulled up with 5,000 bushels of corn in front of my house. That never happens. What happens is you get a delivery receipt that says you own 5,000 bushels of corn in a corn silo someplace in the Midwest. And by the way, you have to pay for it. You don't actually have to pay for it, because what you can do is immediately resell that into the market. So you simply turn around and say, okay, fine, I don't actually want to put up the full value of 100 ounces, so I'm going to take this the deposit and this warehouse receipt, keep it at the clearinghouse, and resell that position into the market. But that's sort of the delivery process. It starts with the shorts issuing a notice to the clearinghouse that they intend to deliver, and then the clearinghouse assigns that receipt for 100 ounces to somebody who's remained long. So there's issues and stops. The first thing is an issue notice, which is a short issuing a notice to the clearinghouse that it plans to deliver against a futures contract. And then the stop is a stop notice that the clearinghouse issues to a long, saying, congratulations, you're now the proud owner of that 100 ounces.
A lot of people have posed the question, well, what happens if someday all of these longs in the COMEX futures market decide to stand for delivery? There won't be enough gold to go around, and oh my gosh, what's going to happen? There's not enough gold in the COMEX warehouse to satisfy all the longs if they were ever to stand for delivery. There's a few fallacies in that argument, I think. Why don't you go ahead and explain them for us?
Well, the most obvious fallacy is the probability. Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, again, and it's not just gold, it's across commodities. The fact of the matter is that most participants in futures markets don't want to deliver and don't want delivery. So the idea that people would stand for the delivery of that gold is highly improbable, because that's not necessarily the nature of the futures market. If they did, the futures exchange and the clearing house have mechanisms by which to settle things. And one of the things they can do is settle for cash. You know, there's a misnomer that you often hear that the COMEX changed the rules on the Hunt brothers in the 1980s. The COMEX did not change the rules. It actually imposed the rules. There was a rule on the COMEX, in the COMEX bylaws, and it was always there, that said, if the market is so volatile that it, you know, that the financial integrity of the market is at risk, the COMEX executives or board can, in its discretion, take such actions as to try to restore stability to a market, including, as they did in 1980 or late 79, issuing notice that they could, that people cannot buy additional long positions. They can only liquidate long positions at that point. So the liquidation only order that came out, I believe, in December of 79, which really was sort of the end, maybe it was January 1980, it was sort of the end of the bull market in silver. And it wasn't that the COMEX changed the rules on the Hunt brothers. It imposed the rules, which allowed the board take such steps as necessary to assure financial integrity, including settling these contracts for cash.
And presumably, if a lot of the people who are participants in the COMEX futures are there for the leverage to start with, they don't have enough cash to actually stand for delivery in all of their contracts if they wanted to.
That's the one thing. You know, the first thing is intent. You know, do people actually want to do this? And the second thing is, do they have the financial wherewithal to do it? And the third thing is, what are their motives? You know, most people aren't involved in futures because they want to break a bank. They're in futures because they want to make money.
With respect to the COMEX futures warehouse, there are both registered and eligible inventories. Please explain what those are about.
First off, the COMEX doesn't have any inventories itself. What it does is it recognizes warehouses or depositories and says you can serve as a depository. So anybody who wants to put in gold as collateral against their positions or delivered through the COMEX will use those. And, you know, Scotiabank, HSBC, I believe, MTB Bank, and Brinks, and there might be a fifth one that I'm not thinking about. These are registered COMEX depositories, and they not only have gold and silver and currency deposits against COMEX positions, but they also have metal that's stored for them or stored with them for other reasons. You know, so if you go to any of those banks, what you'll find is you'll find 100-ounce gold bars that can be delivered against COMEX positions, and you'll find coins, and you'll find other types of gold. You know, you might find 400-ounce bars, you might find kilo bars, a wide variety of collectible coins and things like that. What the COMEX is interested in is the registered stocks. These are stocks of gold in 100-ounce bars that are deliverable against the COMEX. They meet all of the COMEX specifications for grade and identified refinery and size and purity. And they're also interested in the eligible but unregistered stocks. And these are bars that are held in that depository but are not actually registered with the COMEX. Now, if you are going to trade on the COMEX and you have to put up collateral with the clearinghouse, you can put up cash or you can put up gold. So, for example, right now you have about 2.86 million ounces of gold that is in COMEX registered stocks. That's gold that is stored in a COMEX recognized depository. And the owner has taken the warehouse receipt, a little piece of paper or a computer line entry nowadays, and they have said, this is my gold. The depository, when I put the gold there, the depository gave me this slip and said, here's a receipt for your gold. You can come back and get it when you want. And I'm giving that warehouse receipt to the clearinghouse as collateral that I can use against my gold or other futures contracts positions now. So the registered gold is gold that's held in a registered depository, a recognized COMEX depository, that is the warehouse receipt has been given to the COMEX clearinghouse, and the metal's been registered with the COMEX clearinghouse as metal that is there and ready to be delivered against the COMEX should the owner decide to deliver into a short position. There's eligible metal, too, and most of these depositories are working depositories. So if you go to HSBC or Scotia or NTB, you'll find metal moving in and out on a daily basis. Mining companies are delivering newly refined production. Refineries are delivering newly refined production. It's being held there, and then it goes off to an electronics manufacturer or a jeweler or an investor, whoever wants it. So these are working depositories that have a steady flow of metal in and out of their depository on a daily basis. If the metal that flows in meets COMEX delivery specs, it shows up as eligible gold. It's not registered, but it's eligible to be registered. And right now you have about 8.2 million ounces of gold that's held in COMEX recognized vaults that is eligible but not registered. So your total gold stock in COMEX right now is about 11 million ounces, 2.8 of which is held by people who have given the warehouse receipts to the clearinghouse. So that implies that they're active participants in the COMEX. And about 8.2 million of it is held by people who have not given those warehouse receipts to the clearinghouse, which implies that they're not involved in the COMEX. Right? Now, total open interest across all COMEX contracts is about 41 million ounces right now. So you have about almost four times as much open interest against all across all contracts as you have gold in the depositories. Of that 41 million ounces, 22 million ounces are in the most nearby active contract, which is for August. Most of that stuff will roll out. If you look at the June contract, the last June contract, at the beginning of May, you had 22 million ounces of open interest in the June contract. By the time you got down to May 31st, the first delivery date, most of those shorts and longs had rolled out, and you were down to 587,000 ounces of gold open interest in the June contract against 11 million ounces of eligible and registered metal, and 2.5 million ounces of registered. So that's the way a market normally works. By the time you get to the first delivery date, that large open interest in a nearby open active contract has rolled out, and there's enough metal there. But the thing is, the metal doesn't have to be at a COMEX depository prior to delivery. It can be held someplace else. So if I am a short and say that my short is a hedge against a long contract that I have with a refiner. This refiner is refining gold, and they've assured me that by May 31st, they will be delivering 200,000 ounces of gold to me. I can hedge that by shorting the June contract, and I can have some assurance, if I trust the refiner to physically live up to its promises, I can have some assurance that I will be getting 200,000 ounces of gold that I can put into a COMEX registered depository, take the receipts to the COMEX and say, hey, I've got, 2,000 contracts, that I'm short, and here's the gold against it. I'm going to deliver it.
Now, I want to pick up on that point specifically because a lot of people have looked at this and they said, okay, 10 million ounces in the COMEX warehouse. What if more than 10 million ounces worth of longs, which do exist certainly from time to time, stand for delivery? And I think what people sometimes don't realize is it's not just the COMEX inventory. It's also the shorts that have contracts to deliver additional inventory beyond what's already available in the COMEX.
If I'm a short against the COMEX contract, there are several things I can do. I can deliver metal into it, either metal that I'm already storing at the COMEX registered vault or metal that I intend to bring into that vault. That's the least likely thing I'm going to do. I can also buy back my short position or buy a offsetting long position and the two cancel themselves out. Or I can buy back my short position and sell a long position in a forward month, which is called rolling forward your position. And that's what most of these guys actually do. So there are various ways that a short can meet his or her obligation. People, I think, misunderstand that a lot of times.
So to summarize on the COMEX market, you're dealing with a mostly cash-settled market of futures, which is sometimes resolved through physical delivery. And there's a performance bond or margin mechanism so that dictated by the exchange are a set of rules that make sure there's sufficient collateral that everybody can always make good on their obligations or at least have their contracts closed out while making good on them as they're being closed out.
Before we move on, let me give you a concrete example of how a market that is efficient and functioning works. Okay, and let's go back to July of 2011, and let's look at the COMEX gold contract. You know, it's a little bit academic, but I think it might help people. If you remember, in July of 2011, that was when it looked like the world was shaking apart. The European governments and the ECB were fiddling while Athens literally burned. And in Washington, you had these guys diddling with this debt ceiling increase agreement, playing politics with it when they were only a month away. And on July 1st of last year, the price of gold was $1,482 at settlement, and you had 30.7 million ounces of open interest in the active COMEX gold contract. So the world really was at one of its highest risk points over the course of July, going into that first week of August. And in fact, the price of gold went from 1482 to 1628 on the last day of July. Now, in this environment where everything seems to be at greater risk than it has been even in 2008, 2009, if you look at that open interest in the August contract, it went from 30.7 million ounces on July 1st to 798,000 ounces on July 29th. So here's the worst-case situation economically that we've seen since World War II, and most of the people who were long August COMEX chose to get out, right? So when people say, well, yeah, but they could stand for delivery, yes, they could. But here's, like, the worst-case situation in 60 years, and they haven't.
Well, and more to the point, perhaps, if they could, they would have to do so by reducing their leverage.
They would have to buy the stuff.
So they would have to dramatically reduce their positions to what they could afford to buy outright, which would be much smaller in terms of notional exposure.
Yeah, an investor who had put up $16,000 or $15,000 to buy a COMEX contract in the beginning of July would have to come up with $168,000 to actually take delivery.
Let's move on to the London over-the-counter forward market and compare and contrast that to COMEX futures. So I've never traded that market myself, but as I understand it, it's very similar to COMEX futures, except that the contracts themselves being over-the-counter can be rewritten and changed to meet the needs of the participants. Please elaborate for us.
The OTC market is exactly what it is, the over-the-counter market. It's principal to principals. So you have any number of banks and their trading counterparts, institutional investors, mining companies, refiners, all sorts of money managers, high net worth individuals who have agreed among themselves or agreed with some of the other participants to trade. And they've swapped financial statements. They know the creditworthiness of each other. They monitor each other's financial status on a regular basis, usually monthly, sometimes quarterly. And what they'll do is they'll say, let's say that I'm a refinery company XYZ, I may have trading agreements with three different banks. So they have looked at my financials and they said, you can trade up to, you know, $500 million worth of gold with us, and you need to put up something as collateral against it. It's not an official margin as you would have with an exchange, but it's some sort of collateral. You have to keep your financial house in order at a certain level, and if you do that, we will extend you credit, and you can trade against us. And what you have in London, and it's really, it's centered in London, but it is, as I said earlier, it is a web that's spread around the world. You have this web or network of inter-entity agreements, one against each other, principal to principal, that allow each other to trade. Now, they tend to trade 100-ounce or 400-ounce bars, London Good Delivery, recognized metal, and they will take delivery through recognized vaults that are acceptable to the London Bullion Market Association members. You know, the members, the key banks that trade metal have agreed to what kind of bars they'll accept, which brands of bars they'll accept, where they'll accept it. And it's very similar in many ways to a futures market, but it's a principle to principle. You do not have a clearinghouse behind it right now.
Now, as it stands now, with all of this principle-to-principle interdependency between banks, where there's a lot of netting of contracts, where they might be long in one contract and short in another contract, doesn't that create an immense risk if one of those counterparties falls, that it creates a domino effect, as was feared when AIG started to fall?
That's exactly right. And we did see that in 2008 and 2009. We did see a risk. And what happened in 2008, 2009, was that the risks of extending credit to these groups on a principal-to-principal basis rose, so credit lines started being reduced. And people started saying, okay, you have $75 million of trades with me right now, but we are worried about your credit worthiness given the overall financial market instability at this point, so we're reducing your credit line to $50 million. You have to liquidate or 25 million of your positions with us. And that's one of the reasons why gold and silver cascaded down. And it wasn't just the banks and it wasn't just the institutional investors that were suffering, it was also the banks. So one of the things that you saw in late 2008 was a surge in open interest on the COMEX, because as the banks, who were market makers, were taking in all of this metal that was being sold by their institutional investors because they were losing creditworthiness and they had to liquidate, or they needed to liquidate to cover shorts, cover positions in other markets. As the institutional investors and high net worth individuals were selling their gold to the bullion banks were finding that they didn't have enough credit standing with their trading counterparts to sell the stuff and hedge their long purchases. So what they did is they went to the COMEX, where you had the clearinghouse that was standing fast and stable in that environment, and you saw this surge of short selling by banks that normally would have sold in the London bullion market, but because of the credit constriction in the London interbank market, they were trading on the COMEX, where the clearinghouse kept its integrity, and they could get the volumes off that they couldn't get off in London.
So you have a very important distinction then between the COMEX and the OTC market, which is in the COMEX market, the call for additional collateral is mechanical. As the trade goes against you, you owe more money to your broker because that's just the way the computer algorithm works. In the OTC market, the call for additional collateral from a trading partner is discretionary, and that means that when one of these discretionary changes of the winds occurs, it can have a substantial effect on the markets. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, you have to understand there is a tradition and there is competition in these markets. So typically, a bank will not reduce your credit line on an arbitrary basis. They will have real, rational, solid financial reasons for reducing your credit lines. And they'll do that because if they are arbitrary or too arbitrary in their decisions, they'll lose business because people will go to companies that are more reliable in terms of provision of credit. Yeah. Now, you have had a situation, for example, probably around 2004, 2005, there was a major bank that was doing a lot of bullion banking, and the senior management of that bank said, you know what, gold is not a conventional or traditional banking service, so we want to get out of the gold lending business, and let's just liquidate all of our positions. So that bank went to all of its trading counterparts, which included mining companies, industrial users of precious metals and refiners of precious metals, and they said, we're getting out of the gold business and we have 30 days to unwind our book. So you have 30 days to find new credit lines, which was very problematic, and a lot of companies suffered mightily. You can contrast that with another bank in New England that around 2007 maybe decided to get out, and they gave their bankers a full year plus. That is more than a year that they gave their bankers to work with their customers to liquidate those positions and find new trading counterparts for their customers. Yeah, which is a more responsible way to run a bank than to simply come in and say, okay, you have a month to close up, and you, our clients, are, you know, we've been servicing for all these years, you have a month to find new credit lines in a hostile economic environment. Now, let me just throw one other thing in. I mean, we have written about a variety of the structural problems and weaknesses in the banking system and derivatives markets for many years. And going back to the late 1990s, we were always pointing out, like there was a round of talks at the World Bank where we were saying the problem with people say, well, they all net out, so it's a relatively smaller position. And they do all net out in theory, but the problem is that netting doesn't occur simultaneously. And it's something that we were talking about earlier, and it's an issue across financial markets. If you have a run on a bank, and the bank has X deposits, but they've lent all that money out, if the depositors would give the bank enough time, the bank can unwind those loans and give the depositors back 100% of their money. The problem is that the depositors in a bank panic don't do that. They say, no, I want my money now. And then the bank can't meet that requirement. And you can have the same thing. That's one of the things that happened on a lower level in late 2008, where you have depositors saying, I don't want to wait for an orderly liquidation. If you do, then everything can net out and you can unwind things. The problem is that you usually have some people who are impatient and would rather shoot themselves in the foot than wait in line.
It sounds to me like what you're describing in the OTC market includes a very big risk that at some point one of the major players could look at the market, and let's suppose that of the three biggest banks in the world, Bank B, it looks like it's going down. So from a credit management standpoint, everybody else is saying, look, whoever's got a lot of exposure to Bank B, we're worried about them. We can't extend credit to them. So anybody who's got exposure to Bank B, let's unwind the credit that we're giving to those banks. Now everybody that has exposure to Bank B is losing credit, and you potentially get a waterfall effect of everybody's losing their credit lines and is forced to unwind their trades. Is that a realistic concern?
It is a realistic concern, and it does happen, and that's when central bankers and banking regulators step in and say, okay, we have to shore up this bank on a temporary basis at least, in order to assure the financial integrity of the greater system. I mean, this is at the heart of too big to fail.
Well, and this, to me, really sounds like you could have an extreme reverse effect in the market, because in a situation where there's all-out financial Armageddon going on, everybody ought to be fleeing into gold as a safety trade. Potentially, what's happening is the OTC market is unwinding itself as everybody loses their credit and everybody is forced to unwind their trades and everybody's forced to sell. The price of gold potentially crashes at a moment where everybody should want it, because the mechanisms of the market are forcing an outcome that's entirely different than the fundamentals should dictate.
Well, I think there are a couple of things there, but yeah, I mean, and to some extent, that's what you saw in late 2009. But there's a very key thing, which is you said earlier, okay, you have financial Armageddon, and everybody should be fleeing into gold. Not everybody thinks that way, and a lot of people flee into dollars. So one of the things that you see, and a lot of people need dollars to try to shore up parts of their financial empire as everything crumbles around them. So one of the things that you see, as you said earlier, you know, in your question, was that you'll find people selling gold into a financial panic, not because they don't think that gold serves well as a hedge against financial crises, but because they think gold is an excellent source of liquidity in a financial crisis. And so you'll find people selling gold into that crisis, and it's exactly the wrong time because the liquidity is drying up, and so there's nobody there who can buy that gold from you and immediately hedge it. So when they buy the gold from you, they have to mark it down. Now, let's go back to 2008 and say the price is $1,200 and this financial crisis is hitting. You go to your market-making bank and you say, I want to sell this gold. The price is $1,200. He can't find anybody to hedge this against right now because the market's in total chaos. So he says, okay, I'll buy it from you, but I'm not going to buy it from you at $1,200. I'm going to buy it from you at $1,100 or $1,000. Because I'm a bank. I, generally speaking, don't take risk. So if I can't hedge this at $1,200, I got to go off and find somebody who's willing to hedge it at $1,100 or $1,000. And that's exactly why the price spiraled down.
So we've covered the COMEX market, where there's a very mechanical performance bond or margin mechanism. We've covered the OTC market, where there's a fuzzier margin mechanism that's imposed on a discretionary basis as circumstances dictate. Let's move on to allocated and unallocated accounts in bullion banks. And particularly, please describe what reserve ratios has to do with the way that these things are maintained.
Some people don't know that they have unallocated gold. They think they have allocated gold, but they don't. There was a famous case a few years ago in the mid-2000s. We were actually the expert advisors to the plaintiffs against a major investment bank that had been charging storage fees as if the metal were allocated, but in fact the metal was unallocated. And some investors caught on that they were paying storage fees for allocated metal when they in fact had unallocated metal. So there was a settlement. And we worked for the plaintiff in explaining to them what exactly unallocated versus allocated was. It was a very interesting case. But I think other people know that they have unallocated metal, but they don't know what it means to have unallocated metal. They think that they have metal in the bank and that they can go and get it, and it's their metal, and if something happens to that bank, they can still get that metal. They don't realize that unallocated metal is as good as money on deposit with the bank. It now is owned by the bank. The bank can hypothecate it. They can lend against it. They can use it as collateral for other lending. And they have a liability to give it back to you or pay you the value of it, but it's actually their gold at that point.
So we've covered the COMEX and the OTC market. I want to talk about bullion bank accounts, but I'm particularly interested in unallocated accounts. And let me just run a premise past you, Jeff. A lot of people are very concerned about COMEX futures because they see the risk that at some point the longs are going to stand for delivery, there's not going to be enough inventory in the warehouse, there's going to be a default on the COMEX. As I look at it, I just don't see that risk because all the shorts that are on the other side of those contracts have put up performance bonds that are basically assuring that they're going to lose a lot of money if they don't make good on either liquidating their contract or delivering against it. But if I look at unallocated bullion bank accounts, There doesn't appear to be any firm reserve ratio requirement. The bullion banks basically owe gold to the unallocated account holders. They don't have to hold any reserve against it. They don't necessarily, as I understand it, have to even have a capital reserve in any currency against the gold that they owe owners of unallocated accounts. So it seems to me that in the run-on-the-bank scenario, what's really at risk is unallocated accounts that are held by banks that are unequipped to make good on those obligations to their depositors. Would you agree with that, or am I missing something?
I think the unallocated accounts is a greater risk than the COMEX futures. But, you know, if you have a bank, in the United States, the Federal Reserve and the OCC, the Office of Comptroller of the Currencies, regulate nationally chartered banks. And they say that a bank has to have 10% reserve, you know, 10% of its deposits have to be on reserve at the bank to cover normal flow of business at present. And the regulation for gold and silver is that the banks have to have reserves in, and they need to manage their reserve position in a prudent fashion. That's the word of the law. And the bank is given discretion as to decide what a prudent fashion is. And a lot of nationally chartered banks tend to use 8 or 10% reserve requirements for their gold. So they'll lend out, if it's 10%, if they're using a 10% reserve requirement, they'll lend out 10 times as much gold as they have on deposit. If it's not a bank, there's no such stricture against it. So that, you know, and if you go back to the pre-Fed days, I mean, part of the problem that caused boom after bust after boom after bust from really the birth of the Republic until the creation of Fed was that you didn't have a national banking system. So you had state banking systems, and the states would charter people. States would allow people to be banks, and they would allow the banks to issue currency, their own currency, against their deposits. And the states, generally speaking, didn't have regulators or inspectors that would come around and say, okay, you know, the First National Bank of Illinois have issued $100 million worth of currency. Do you, in fact, have $10 million of deposits in your bank that I can see right now? And the reason why we had so many bank panics up until 1907, 1913, was because you had very lax banking regulations. And the creation of the Fed was an effort to try to bring in national regulation and oversight, including bank inspectors, who would go in and say, okay, you know, are you meeting the reserve requirements? And part of the compromise was that you would have nationally chartered banks and state chartered banks and then savings and loans, and the state chartered banks didn't come under the national inspection. So if you look at the period from, say, 1914 until, well, the 1980s, with the savings and loan crises, one of the problems that you had where you had these non-nationally chartered banks that often got into trouble by lending out more than they had reserves to cover. So that is a problem, and it continues to be a problem, and events since 2008 have shown that this is a real risk. The joke when I started on Wall Street was that bankers don't take risks. They make their money on their margins, on their deposits, on a very small spread between what they're paying people for deposits and what they're charging people for loans. The joke was that bankers wore belts and suspenders. They were so cautious. But I think 2008, 2009 showed that not all bankers wear suspenders.
Well, that certainly is true. And I would say that the hidden message that I see here is that a lot of people don't put a lot of faith in what they consider to be paper gold products. COMEX futures are paper contracts. It's not physical bullion. But a lot of people that I've met do put a lot of credence in these unallocated bullion accounts. And although that is, in theory, a call on physical metal as opposed to a futures contract, it's metal that the bank might or might not have, and that about 10 times as many people have a claim on as the bank probably has gold in-house in their vault to satisfy. So it seems to me that the unallocated bullion account is a much higher systemic risk than the futures exchanges or the LBMA forwards market or any of the other markets for that matter.
I think I agree with you, yeah.
What about the ETFs? A lot of people have described ETFs as being a big risk, a big paper market. You know, I really don't see the risk there, Jeff. What I see is very complex structures that are hard to understand in terms of all their intricate interoperations and how the issuer relates to the authorized participants and so forth. But at the end of the day, all the metal is there and it's all audited every year, isn't it?
Well, I think the ETFs, I mean, if you go back to my discussion about nationally chartered banks versus state chartered banks a couple minutes ago, that goes to my heart of the ETFs. I mean, if you look at the major ETFs, they're run by very large banks, you know, multi-trillion dollar banks that are present in maybe 200 countries. They have national bank regulators reviewing their books, reviewing their legal documents on a regular basis. In many banks now, you have very large contingents of permanently embedded bank regulators. These are federal officials that sit at the bank all year long, monitoring the bank's activity on a daily basis. That's typical at the larger banks nowadays. So if you have an ETF that's run by a major multi-trillion dollar bank, and it's a gold or a silver ETF, the idea of that bank doing something sloppy and trying to rip off investors on what's a very small piece of their business is very low in my mind, because if they got caught doing that, the cost in terms of losing, you know, strictures and fines and losing national charters to be a bank in countries around the world is so enormous. So I think that there's very low real economic incentive for a major bank running a major ETF to do that. When you go down market and you get into ETFs run by brokers who don't come under banking regulations or national entities, then I think, you know, the integrity of the owners and managers of the companies that are running those ETFs become much more important.
To summarize, we've talked about ETFs really providing a fairly sound mechanism to hold interest in gold. COMEX futures contracts providing a very mechanical approach to enforcing changes in collateral and so forth. OTC forwards are now introducing a little bit of discretion as to when a banker might impose an additional collateral requirement. And really, the unallocated bullion account is, from my perspective, sitting at the bottom of the stack in terms of how reliable it is. And I think it's really unfortunate because a lot of people who own those accounts feel that they've got physical metal and that they're safer than anyone in a so-called paper product. And I don't think that that's really accurate. Let's move on from the mechanisms of various markets to the gold leasing trade. What is central bank leasing all about, and how does it play into the gold carry trade?
First off, gold leasing these days is probably much less a central bank phenomenon than it is an institutional investor phenomenon. I was at J. Aron in 1980-81, and then we merged into Goldman. We were at the forefront of helping to create the gold leasing market for central banks. And it was a very exciting time because you'd go to a central bank and you'd say, we would like to borrow your gold. And they would say, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, we'll borrow your gold and we'll pay you an interest rate. And they say, well, what kind of interest rate? And I say, well, how about 30 basis points, you know, 0.3%? And they say, well, that's very low. I said, well, how much are you earning for your gold now? Oh, wait, you know, you're not. So we started borrowing gold from central banks, and it was a very efficient way of doing things. And what you saw were central banks that were sitting on gold as a residual of the old international currency systems that used gold for international settlements. Sitting on this gold, they were earning no interest on it. It was valued at $35 or $42 an ounce in most cases. A lot of it wasn't good delivery. So we would do what we call upgrade swaps. We would borrow non-good delivery gold from a central bank, and then at the end of the lease, we would return good delivery gold. And we would return basically the same value of gold, but less volume of gold because we had charged for the cost of upgrading the gold.
And just to clarify for our listeners, good delivery gold means gold that has been certified to be acceptable into the London Bullion Market Association system.
Exactly. You also had gold that was stored at the New York Fed, which only will accept deposits at the time in the 1980s, the Fed would only accept deposits from foreign governments. They changed their charter so they would also hold gold for the U.S. Treasury after 1980. It was sometime in the 1980s they did that. But as a result, you had a lot of gold, some more than 300 million ounces of gold, that was held at the New York Fed for on the account of foreign central banks. And they still have, I think, about 200 million ounces. But if you, a private bank, wanted to borrow that gold, you had to take it out of the Fed. And sometimes you just move it literally across the street to Chase Manhattan's vault. But sometimes the banks would say, look, I'll loan you gold in New York, and we'll take it out of the Fed, and you can take that gold and you can use it. And when you pay me back with gold at the Bank of England. So you have a locational swap built into your lease. And so we were doing a lot of trades like that. What we've seen over the last few years was that central banks have pulled back from lending for a variety of reasons. First off, higher credit risks involved in it. Second thing is that the lease rates have fallen from where they had gotten to, and that relates to the third one, which is that as private institutional investors and high net worth individuals started owning more and more gold, and private entities now own more gold than central banks. Central banks are down to about 1 billion ounces of gold. Private investors, including institutions, have about 1.2 billion ounces of gold. And some of those guys were leasing the gold out into the market, and that would drive the interest rate down. And they would also do it on sort of creditworthy light type terms. So the central banks would be very cautious, especially after the Drexel Burnham bankruptcy in the late 1980s. The central banks would be extremely cautious and extremely detailed in the terms of their leases or swaps. I should get back to that one in a second. Whereas the private investors sometimes would be a little bit less stringent in their terms and conditions. So banks that wanted to borrow gold would do that. Now, I mentioned leases and swaps. A lot of the leases are no longer leases. They're swaps or repurchase agreements. I will give you money. You will give me gold. And that's just a way of avoiding some of the risks of leasing gold to private entities. But what we've seen really over the last, say, 15 years is that central banks have pulled back from lending as much gold out, and private sources of gold have continued to have increased the amount of gold they're lending out.
With respect to the gold carry trade, I think a lot of our listeners understand the basic concept of a currency carry trade, where you go and, say, borrow a whole bunch of Japanese yen because the interest rates are very low, go invest them in a country that pays a higher rate of return, convert the money back, and eventually you've made a profit. What's the gold carry trade about? How does that work?
The gold carry trade is the same as a currency carry trade. You borrow gold at, 25 basis points, 30 basis points. You sell the gold, you take the proceeds, and you invest it in a higher interest rate-bearing government bond, and you earn the differential. You have to hedge yourself by buying forward to cover your gold price risk, but typically, the interest rate differential that you earn by reinvesting at a higher rate versus what you're paying for your gold is far in excess of what the cost of buying a futures contract is, the contango. So if you look at it, you've got a cost of money of, say, 30 basis points. You have a contango of maybe 1%. So you got 1.3%, and you reinvest that money in a government bond that might be paying 4 or 5%, and you're making several percentage profits. And you're doing it on a hedged basis. So it's one of the cheapest, most secure forms of financing for private financial institutions.
And who's in that trade primarily, and how big is it?
It's hard to say because it's totally opaque, but there are quite a few major banks that are doing it. I mean, there's one bank I know in Japan that we've looked at them for years, and we've said if they weren't doing the carry trade, they probably wouldn't be allowed to be in the gold business because, the carry trade gives the bank's treasury the cheapest money that it could find up until now with the financial crisis. But in addition to that, they didn't seem to do that much commercial business either. So we always thought that the bank would probably have said, well, why are we supporting this bullion desk? But for the fact that they were providing very cheap financing to the parent bank. But you have major banks around the world that will do gold carry trades. And then you also have institutional investors that do it. One of the myths that you find in both the currency carry trade and the gold carry trade is the idea that these guys are doing this on a naked basis. I mean, typically, if you're a bank and you're doing a carry trade, you're going to hedge yourself with a forward repurchase of the underlying currency or gold. If you're an institutional investor, you might take a naked position and not hedge yourself. But the major banks all tend to hedge themselves.
Fascinating. Well, we are unfortunately out of time. My guest on the program has been Jeff Christian of CPM Group. Jeff, please tell our listeners where they can follow more of your work.
CPM Group has a website, www.cpmgroup.com. We're about to roll out a new website probably within a couple weeks, but the current website is quite good, and you can go there. You can get some free reads from our free library, various reports, press releases, and other things that we've done over the years, and you can order our annual yearbooks, our monthly precious metals advisory, or our long-term studies.
I have the annual gold and silver yearbooks myself, and I recommend them highly. They are a treasure trove of information. But again, we are out of time, so thanks for tuning in. Again, if you have any suggestions for future topics or guests for the next level, please email me your suggestions through the Financial Sense website. For the Financial Sense NewsHour, I'm Eric Townsend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.